Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Casterbrus podcast. Yes, with a K. Available on Casterbrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. It all started as a mild curiosity by these Casterbrites, and now it's turned into quite a spirit of adventure, don't you think? Listen!
Give me a K, because K. It's the podcast with a K. Thank you, Brian. I'm Christian Corley. That's James McLean.
I was not going to get into that. That's...
chuckling in the background, and Brian Turnover is with us also. Give us a K. That makes me that cast my mind back, James, to Play Away.
Play Away. I was thinking more of cheerleaders. Give me a K. Give me an ass. Give me a T. And what do we get?
Castert.
There
was a conversation on Facebook a few days ago, and I think it was something that Gareth Cavana was involved in, and it was mentioning Jeremy Irons, who was in Play Away. Brian, there was this children's TV show in the 70s and early 80s called Play Away. Jeremy Irons, who you probably know from Die Hard 2, 3, beg your pardon, and he was in it. Tony Robinson, who was Baldrick.
Yes, okay.
He was on it as well. There's lots of people on it from time to time. Anyway, this conversation, it was a very, very fun children's TV show, quite theatrical. And this conversation basically degenerated into a discussion of Jeremy Irons being a bit of a bastard. It's completely unreliable. He's constantly trying to blow you up. You should have seen the episode of Play Away when Brian Cant and Derek Griffiths run around London trying to stop bombs going off. That's basically what it was, James.
I see.
Yeah. I've been chuckling about it all weekend, really. Such is my fascinating
hashtag
life.
Deviation.
We're going Uber with a social media hashtag in today, aren't we?
I think we will.
Sorry,
I
we're like going hash Uber that. With a social media hashtagging. Listen. Did you watch Listen?
Yes.
Did I watch? Oh right, I see what you did there.
Well.
Yeah, I did watch it.
Now it's getting lots and lots and lots of very positive plaudits. I personally think, although overnights were down to 4.8 million, which I don't think that's much of a problem given the time of year. There's only, you know, it's not dark. And I haven't seen what the audience share was, but I imagine it's still in the third 30% sort of neck of the woods. However, it's an overnight and it doesn't really matter because I think this is a blink. I think this is a slow burner. I think there will be a lot of people catching up tonight. We're recording this on Monday afternoon, dear listener. I remember with Blink, the overnights weren't that strong, but after people had talked about it the following Monday and Tuesday morning, they rocketed up. They increased by about a third, if memory serves correctly, and I haven't checked this out, but I do remember they were low on the overnights.
You could argue that overnights, to a certain degree, are... My God, I've got Play Away running on YouTube.
Have you?
So we can put it in the podcast notes and people can see why I was slowly going loopy by the 2 minutes 23 seconds.
Right.
What was I saying? Yeah, overnights can be sort of more indicative of the week before. People's reactions to the previous
question
of whether they will actually tune in the next week. So if you get a low overnight for a show, obviously there's loads of factors, but one factor could be that the appreciation of the week previous didn't encourage him to watch again. What was before Blink? Just trying to think out the top of my head.
42, I think.
Was it 42? Which had me...
Ryan's the expert on the 10th Doctor.
What, episode-wise, what was before Blink?
Yeah.
I think it was 42.
Did it go from 42? You may be right there. I can double-check us on that.
Well, it might have been Human Nature, then Blink.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was Family of Blood.
Oh, yeah, it's your Family of Blood, nature, which was actually
Blink.
Very...
Right, yeah, I was thinking it was Blink, then Human Nature, but yeah, you're quite right, yeah.
Okay, anyway, yeah, but that's the point, so, yeah. Plus, maybe, you know, maybe it didn't appeal to a lot of... I mean, it was quite a dark one for kids. Maybe parents were uncertain from the trailers whether it was suitable.
Oh, I still don't understand what's wrong with that. Go on, Brian, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say I was surprised because normally when the episodes were a little bit darker, they changed the airing time to like an hour or two later. But yeah. They didn't do it for this one.
Well, it's been permanently 7:30 this year as well, which is another interesting factor, because most of the Matt Smith era, it's been sort of 6:20, 6:50, and sort of like finishing before 8 o'clock, well before 8 o'clock. And this time round, it's had that later start. When Rose was on, was that 7:30 or was that 7 o'clock? I think it was 7 o'clock back in 2005. Doctor Who was on at 7 o'clock. Let's move on from that and into the episode itself. Nice tight cast, I thought. There was only one other guy, wasn't there?
Mm.
Whose name escapes me, but he's been in Doctor Who before. He was in The Trial of the Time Lord, Terror of the Vervoids, and I think he was in one or two others. Apart from that, this is the guy who is in charge of the children's home. I don't want to get into anything that happened recently on Casterbras. But having a Doctor Who story about a children's home, in light of certain things that have been in the news, certainly raised an eyebrow on my head.
I wasn't aware of something in the news.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be, but there's been a lot of problems with care homes over here and child abuse.
Ah, really?
Yeah.
But again, if we make too much of that distinction, then obviously you end up sort of being on the opposite side of where a lot of people were on the previous week with the beheading.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, I know. I'm not going anywhere near it or even using that word. Made me wonder about this editorial thing of the BBC's. But we will continue beyond that now and say, how did we feel about the episode? I mean, was this a really great episode of Doctor Who? Was this one of the best episodes of Doctor Who? Has it been over milked in this whole one of the best things? Is it a classic? Is it a classic Moffat, or is it, you know, is it the Wedding of River Song?
I think it's a classic Moffat, given that, as I've said many times before, I don't think his actual output of late, the last few years, has been very good.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a lot of borrowing in there still, which from his own little writing box. I was even surprised that they even threw in the From the Corner of Your Eye as part of the nursery rhyme, which again linked to one of his other previous episodes of Corner of Your Eye stuff with 11th Hour.
11th Hour, yeah.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was very well constructed. It was neatly put together.
If you can't borrow from yourself, though, who can you borrow from?
Well, hopefully you'd create new material or read other people's stuff and generate.
Yeah, I agree.
I know. Yeah. But, I mean, to be honest, I mean, obviously he likes the idea of having this sort of motif, you know, listen, blink. There's a, you know, he likes this singular, almost fairy tale approach to.
Oh, I don't think you should say fairy tale anymore.
Who doesn't say fairy tale?
Well, I don't think we're allowed to say fairy tale in connection to Doctor Who anymore.
Why not?
Because it's dark now. He says,
dark. I still have issue with forced romances, and he does this. This is another River Song thing.
Oh, no, I was wondering how you felt about that, because
I didn't like
it. You didn't like it? I was thinking it was okay at first, but then when she came back, when she convinced the Doctor to take her back, I think that's when I started thinking, I don't think this is really going anywhere now.
I think the problem for me is that, you know, you've got various different sort of either genres or story plots that you can run through shows. Romance works well, as I said before, when you allow it to generate naturally. If you look at great romances in television and film, it's ones where you weren't pushed into it, that the audience moved along with the romance, and that's what generates the interest to a point of fever pitch in some.
Give us some examples, James.
Well, I mean, obviously you can go, the most obvious, famous example is Moonlighting. Where that was a sort of will they won't they for many seasons. You get loads. I mean, if you want to go into science fiction, some people would cite Babylon 5's Sheridan Delenn. Some people would cite early. If you want to go into the show, okay, it never flowered. But Ian and Barbara would be a good example of where you follow characters to the point where you feel, yes, I would like to see these characters get together because they've been through so much. It feels natural. When it's pushed, and he seems to do this all the time, he pushes things. Mm-hmm. He can't let things develop naturally. It feels, from an audience point of view, I feel reticent to actually to go with the flow, because I feel as if I'm being dragged, and I don't like being dragged. And also, I feel it becomes sort of slightly disingenuous, because there's no naturalness to it. If I was, to be honest, and I don't know if it works in character either, because I'm not sure many characters, if you found out that you were not only going to be with this guy that you quite liked but you weren't sure of, but you were going to have a whole legacy following it, a lot of people would balk from that. They wouldn't suddenly just leap into the person's arms. They'd feel majorly uncomfortable because suddenly your whole life is no longer your own. It's manifest destiny sort of becomes something unbelievably claustrophobic. So I don't think it even works within characters. So yeah, I thought it was a beautifully paced story. I thought the acting was great in it. I thought the set pieces were good. I thought the way he wove it all together was quite beautiful. I thought the payoff at the end was really strong. My only real grumble with it was I kind of felt that the pressure, as with River Song and the Doctor, to go down romance, and it almost feels as if the writer is nervous that people aren't going to like it, like the River Song. Almost feels like there's a sort of subconscious fear that people won't like the romance that they're creating, so they bolt it down. So you have to like it, whether you like it or not, as if that gives them, I don't know. What do you feel, Brian?
Well, I like the episode. I don't want to say that I loved it, because I did just enjoy it, and I thought it was really good, and I'm glad to see that so far all of them I have enjoyed. There were a couple elements in there that were, you know, I guess I could have done without, but I don't know if the dating one or the Clara Danny relationship was really all that bad to me. Like, I agree, in the last episode it happened kind of suddenly, but what you were saying about how you like to see relationships grow and develop, I get that, and I agree with that. In many cases, that is like the best way to do it, certainly with a long-term TV show. But with Doctor Who, the way it kind of runs through its companions these days, it seems like you do have to do them quickly if you're going to do them at all. But outside of that, it also echoes reality. I mean, how many people in this world kind of meet somebody in the first instance and kind of realize, I would like to date this person or get to know more about this person at the very least, you know, and rather than, like, in real life, we don't have the luxury of watching these relationships develop and grow like that all the time. You know, sometimes you just meet somebody, and if you don't let them know that you're interested in that moment in time, then they can be gone to you forever. And I think that it's okay to show that sometimes in film, is that, and I understand that they're working together, so maybe that scenario is not the best, but still, I don't think it's unnatural for two people to just kind of instantly feel an attraction for each other and start moving towards each other. And maybe it's too quick for a TV show, but if they're going to go down that route with it, you know, I think this episode did it well.
But that's the
reason I think it happened well, is because I did like the fact that I like time travel, and I like when you can play with time travel. And I like the fact that Clara had that option that all of us probably wished we had at some point, where you can sit there and say to somebody, your friend, and say, do me a favor, take me back to this time that I really just completely screwed something up. I would like to have a second chance at that, you know, because, I mean, for her, it wasn't exactly breaking the rules of time in a sense. You still could have gone back to that moment if she had turned around, and all, you know, we don't really know what actually did happen there. And I liked it. I liked the way that it played out. I thought that it was okay. I liked that it was all woven into the story together. I felt it worked within itself a lot better than the last episode, as much as I enjoyed that episode with Danny. I did agree that that felt like a little forced in that one, but I felt it worked here, personally.
Okay. I think, you know, that in future we should maybe have a section on the podcast called The Shipping Forecast, where James McLean tells us how happy he is with relationships in Doctor Who.
Well, I just feel if they hadn't done it with River Song, I think I'd have been less. But this is, you know, it's the same thing again. As soon as he brings in a relationship thing, he feels he has to sort of bolt it in, and I don't like that. I don't think I agree that you do have relationships which do kick off on the spur, but at the same time, you could have villains that you could finish by punching them in one blow, but it doesn't make it interesting television. I think television to bring you in dramatically. And as I said, I think there is a sort of parochial element we are with characters, that we do, you know, if we like characters, like we like the Doctor, we like Clara, and they're sort of, someone else is showing interest in them, or they've got interest in someone else, you want to feel that they are worthy of those characters. And to that, you need to see them play. I think they should have played, I know what you mean, Brian, it's a short season so far as drama goes in a show like this, so you don't have much time.
Yeah.
I just kind of feel it'd be more satisfying to have had him on board and let them, even over two or three episodes, you can play it out. I mean, films do it in a film. You can do it successfully in a film if you play it perfectly. And I just, but beyond that, I think it was a good episode, certainly, yeah.
Well, I'm going to counter that opinion, though, still, because while I don't disagree with you, because I do think that is generally the better way to go.
You're not countering his opinion if you're not disagreeing.
No. I am countering
now. I don't think they noticed.
Awesome. No, but when you said that, you know, knocking out the villain in the beginning with a punch isn't very dramatic and it's not very interesting, I disagree. I think it's all in how you approach it.
Yeah, so take
a Batman film, have Batman meet his villain for the first time. He knocks him out in 2 seconds. The guy goes to jail to Arkham Asylum, but he spends that time in jail figuring out how the heck he's going to get revenge and essentially, if you want, bettering himself as a villain so that he comes out
throughout the
movie plays this twisted game with Batman until at the very end.
You're being pedantic with it. What I mean is the punch was the final blow of the... Do you know what I mean? Not that there would be something beyond it. If that was it, then you had 50 minutes of nothing.
Because what I'm saying is for instance, like I'm agreeing with you on the River Song aspect. We already had that kind of, you know, they saw each other throughout time, and I think that's boring and done and over. But what I'm saying is you throw the Danny and Clara relationship together rather quickly, rather than spend your time on the show showing us this budding relationship over time, and then they kind of leave the show together because aren't they happy in love, which we always get. We always get to see these relationships bud and grow in TV shows. What we don't get to see is the aftermath of those relationships oftentimes. We don't get to see the effects of those relationships or the other hardships that they go through as a relationship, the things that make them stronger once they're already together.
So hashtag ain't in Rory. Sorry, Karen.
Well, you know, but still, no, at the same time, we watched those two, even though they were together and they were getting married, we had to watch them grow together still because the doctor was kind of this foil in there that kind of took Amy from it. And we had to watch Amy kind of decide, yes, Rory is the guy for me, you know? And we did. So yes, we did sort of get that. But what I'm saying is rather than slowly bring them together and kind of do the marry off Clara, so she leaves the show situation, I don't mind a different approach where we get to bring them together in a different way and watch other things happen with it. I don't like that we're doing the River Song thing over again, where Clara has now met him in his life and his kid's life and so on and so forth. I also don't like the fact that the doctor, ever since Matt Smith came into the show, has met every one of his companions with the exception of Rory as a child. You know, I just think that's tiresome. That's over and that's done. But I didn't mind this aspect because, like I said, I liked the way this happened. It was two people who felt an instant attraction. They decided to go on a date together. You know, things went south because both of them apparently have diarrhea of the mouth, as people say. And
do they?
Yeah, unfortunately, here it's an expression. Yeah, and I thought it was fun. I thought it was an interesting way to watch that, especially since we didn't get to bring the doctor in the mix of these two starting their relationship. You know, I think it's a little bit more.
He doesn't really know what's going on, does he?
No. Just to clarify, I did think that it worked better in this than Into the Dalek. I thought as I said before, I thought it stuck out like a sore thumb and took out time. This felt woven in. So while I'm still not sure I totally believe that Clara would be so comfortable with her world being mapped out, so within the context of the story, it worked fine. It's more of an overall issue. Although saying on the whole, here's a hypothesis, and I'm going to hashtag it. Hashtag Doctor Who hypothesis.
Okay.
Is there a chance here that we could be being misled? And I was thinking about, I was talking to a friend about this, when we have at the end, we have the revelation of it being the Doctor. Is there still a chance? Okay, and I know this is still the hut that we push with the war the War Doctor. Is there a chance that this could still be the Master?
Yeah, I think there is.
Yes. Absolutely. I was going to bring that up myself because that's exactly what I thought when I saw the scene.
Okay,
I felt they're pressing the Doctor on us so heavily that they want us desperately to think it's the Doctor. So there's two ways of doing that. There's either they're introducing John Hurt as the Doctor scene where it's like, yes, kids, this really is the Doctor. We're forcing it upon you. You can't think anything else. Or please, everybody, think this is the Doctor because I don't want you to realize it's really the Master, which I felt it was a perfect setup with Clara telling the doctor, don't look at this, don't go out there, don't do anything. She clearly thinks it's the doctor, but if the doctor saw it, he'd know within 2 seconds it wasn't him. And I think, to me personally, if they don't go there, I'd be very surprised, because I feel that's very heavily where they're going.
Well, you know, there's a very strong BBC editorial thing, and this goes above Moffat, as far as I'm aware, because it previously went above the showrunner, that you don't, that there's no, you can't show the doctor before William Hartnell. You can't portray the doctor before William Hartnell, yeah.
Perhaps he would argue this was William Hartnell.
Well, he could. In a way, I suppose he could, yeah. Well, but at the same time, it's clearly not.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's why they also shadowed out the face, too, and maybe that's a way of getting around that, if it isn't the Master, of course.
Well, the other factor is that we're still talking about the Clara's timeline and how it connects, and obviously the soldier, the toy soldier, which we don't see the doctor has, you know, which you thought might appear at the end if that was the case. And of course, soldier being linked to sort of more of a warlike character. So again, you've got a sort of link to the Master. Here's the hypothesis. No, this, I was going to hashtag hypothesis of Doctor Who, but I can't, because it's not a hypothesis, it's a question. If it does turn out that this was the Master, do you think that damages this story as a standalone, as it plays out, on the assumption it's the Doctor?
No, I think it'll probably give us something to go back and look at again.
Karen Nova?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Give me the hypothesis again. I apologize. I was thinking something.
He decided it wasn't a hypothesis. It's a hash question now.
It's a hashtag question. It's hashtag question on hashtag hypothesis of Doctor Who. If this turns out to be the Master, does it damage Listen as an individual episode, the poignancy of Listen as an individual episode, on the assumption it's the Doctor?
No, I don't think so, because I think what it does instead is it expands on it. Because we clearly know the Doctor has had that dream. We clearly know that he has been affected by this fear ever since he was a kid. The Doctor has admitted that and told us that, you know. But what now we get, instead of the Doctor actually living an experience where Clara was the dream in reality, and the Doctor thinking it was a dream and an irrational fear all these years, we just know that the Doctor had one of those dreams. But instead, we get one more driving force for the Master, one more little bit of fear for him. You know, like maybe he was aware it wasn't a dream, but there was this thing for real under his bed. You know, I think that's an interesting expansion on it, which I do like when they can do that. I like when we can revisit older stories or even just a previous episode and kind of expand on the idea. So if that's the case, I think it would work personally.
Here's another one. Do you think there was actually a creature in this, or do we take that again? There seems to be a lot of ambiguity in this series, which I quite like. Was there actually a creature, or is this just an embellishment of the Doctor's own fears?
There's the shot of the kid or whatever, the creature taking the blanket off, and you can kind of get a glimpse of like a blurred figure. And yeah, I guess it could be a kid's head, but it also looks a bit more like it's kind of bald and odd shaped, the head, you know. So it kind of seemed to me like there was something there. And personally, I like to lean in the camp, as much as it's funny to think that it's an actual kid out there, I like to lean in the camp that there is a creature that is just perfect at hiding, and its only goal is to hide. Like, it was never actually a threat. The fear in the episode was still just the irrational fear. And therefore, this creature was just incidental. Like, while you were researching your irrational fear, you did come across an actual creature that was perfect at hiding. And yes, that is all it was really wanting to do. I like, because mainly because I like that element. But I agree, it can easily go either way.
What about you, Christian?
I mean, there are questions in there. You know, there's a pink ET-esque creature behind them that it's completely out of focus. I just want to say, Douglas McKinnon's direction was absolutely superb, wasn't it?
It's
absolutely brilliant piece of direction. Even if you don't consider it the best Doctor Who episode, it's got to be up there with one of the best directed. It was superbly done. The suspense and the tension in that particular scene was excellent. And I was watching it at midnight as well. I'm really taking this watching Doctor Who in the dark to extremes, aren't I? it's difficult, isn't it? It depends how you want to watch it. And I think it was written and directed in such a way that you could take it either way for the majority of it, until you get to the end and then you decide what you want to do, and then you decide, if we find out later on, as we've already discussed, whether it was the Doctor or not, then in that bed, then we've got lots of different things that we can take from it. I think it's a very well produced episode. I think it's cleverly written. I think there's a clever concept and theme in there that that make it eminently rewatchable in a way that perhaps Deep Breath maybe isn't, and probably Robot Show would probably isn't as well.
It was very good. I'm not sure whether I would cast it in the same light as Blink. Mm-hmm. Maybe Blink has the benefit of it being truly unique, while there was some very nice.
Well, Blink's probably unique and unexpected.
Yes,
wasn't it? Whereas people have been kind of wanting this sort of episode since 2010. Really, I'm not saying we haven't had any others that haven't been in this same sort of ballpark, but I'm saying this is the kind of thing that people wanted from Stephen Moffat in 2010, isn't it?
Yeah, I think to a certain degree. But I mean, I think what. They're two different beasts, aren't they? I mean, Blink's power comes in sort of like a threefold approach, doesn't it? That it is slightly doctorless, which makes it a lot more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you've got a very strong enemy created for the show, which works very, very well. And then also you've got the timey-wimey stuff that's all in flux, which just
and
adds
you've got Solid
to the narrative.
As well, Roto Companion.
Yes, so you've got a lot of interesting things in the mix there. With this one, I don't think it was quite as so many threads that were quite as powerful. I think Capaldi held it together extremely well.
Yeah, I loved his smile.
Again, he felt slightly different to the previous ones. Each time we see him, it does still feel like it's a slightly different vision of this one doctor. I quite like that in a weird way. But even his facial expressions, there was stuff he was doing here which he hadn't done in the previous episodes. There was a smile that he did at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which was very different to what I've seen him before. The way he tells Clara to get into the TARDIS was extremely, was very different again. Yet at the same time, there was bits that were very similar, like the hugging thing was good fun.
I'll tell you, if you want to go back to Moffat tropes, what is it with Moffat and spacemen?
Oh, yeah, right. Did anybody else notice, too? A friend of mine had mentioned this to me.
No, I didn't see your friend, no.
I did, yeah. Well, he was here. You didn't see him? He was hiding under a blanket.
No, I didn't see him.
I had noticed it, but like I just didn't really kind of give it a thought. But then it does make absolutely no sense. But Orzen Pink, not only was he wearing the familiar spacesuit, which is okay, reusing spacesuits, but it still had the SB6 on it from the Sanctuary Base patch on it.
Oh, dear, that's
really?
Bad.
Yeah, supposedly it still had the. I had to double check myself, but because I thought I saw it, but my friend mentioned it to me. And I'm like, okay, you're right, because I remember seeing that. Because I don't think they even removed it, if I'm not mistaken. Obviously, they didn't remove it from Matt Smith when he wore it, because he was supposed to just still have the same suit. But that was one of the reasons why, I guess. Or they may have done it actually, possibly on purpose, so that people would have just thought it was the Doctor, like we were supposed to think it was the Doctor. But that still seems a little like if you're going to do that, you got to give a good reason as to why he was going to be the first time traveler wearing a spacesuit from the future.
Perhaps it isn't his. Maybe it is the Doctor's, and there was an event which required him to get a new suit.
Yeah, but he was in the news footage wearing that suit.
Oh, bollocks.
At least that's what I remember. So I'm actually going through to check it out right now.
But it's very Doctor Who, that, isn't it? I mean, you know, for people like us, sort of old people, where we remember the old show, and, you know, things like that was just all the time. You know,
at the same time, though, 21st century, continuity, someone's paid for this sort of thing, aren't they? Make sure that kind of thing doesn't get spotted.
You'd think.
Yeah. They should.
But
and
then
yet,
the show's
totally
filled
has
with
the
that.
SB6 patches on, that's for sure.
Maybe it means something else. Maybe in the future, SB6 means... Syme Bavel or something. That's failed, hasn't it?
Sure.
Well, it could be that his it could be the name of his ship just by some weird coincidence. It was
and
was
they
there.
Happen to do the exact same patch for it. Yeah, he's totally wearing the spaceship. He's wearing the spacesuit on his maiden voyage there. So yeah, that should have been called. I don't mind if it's the same suit because hey, you know, whatever. Maybe we can just assume that was like the most efficient spacesuit humans have ever made. We'll go with that, but that patch should have gone.
Yeah, definitely.
That really should have gone.
Definitely.
Maybe his voyage in his ship, which was called the Sebastian Back. was considered such a monumental thing that happened in history that all suits after that event were modelled in homage to his loss.
Maybe I've just got to say something there.
Yeah.
When you're saying Sebastian Bach, are we talking Skid Row?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Could have gone with his real name, Sebastian Burke, as I remember rightly. But yeah, Sebastian Bach. Excellent. Slaves to the grind.
Slaves to the grind. Indeed.
Monkey business. Get the out.
It's gone wild.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay, well, your wild. Idea goes away like... there, James, because on his right arm, he's wearing a patch that actually says Sanctuary Base.
Okay, maybe his ship was called Sanctuary Base. And then afterwards, every base made
maybe
had to be called Sanctuary Base.
Maybe that ship took off from Mars. Maybe the time travel experiment occurred on...
Yeah.
We're struggling now.
We are struggling. We're struggling, but, you know, it's kind of fun. I mean, that's what makes these shows amusing, isn't it? I mean, that's a frustrating... I was interested...
It's not even the Mars spacesuit, though. It's the black hole one from the Satan Pit.
Yeah.
Wherever the heck they were at the planet of what was the name of that planet that apparently had no name within the story? Krop Tor. It doesn't have a name, but it's called Krop Tor.
I mean, I love this. I mean, I was reading on Space 1999 as we've been watching season two of it, and there's a discrepancy that one of the season one episodes suggests that it's set in 2002, sort of like 3 years or so after the moon is blasted out of orbit. And then at the beginning of season two, it says it's 340 days after the moon's been blasted out of orbit, which is 2000. And changes in the sets and cast, which makes it very hard to swap episodes around to make that work. And I read one very smart guy who's obviously had this same sort of issues, just sat there and thought, how do I make this work? And he suggested that there was a time warp, which sent the moon back in time by a few years. And the commander decided that they would reset their clocks to the time that they are now in, which is so that now their time is 300 days since they were blasted out of orbit, thanks to the time warp going backwards. I mean, that's an incredibly convoluted way to get past a problem. But that's some of the fun of it, isn't it? It's like this. I'm sure someone will come up with a way. And I wish them luck to explain this. I'm not quite sure how. I think you'd probably actually have to have a timey-wimey story around this. Something maybe where the doctor gives him that suit before he takes off.
I was just going to say that. Yeah, like, hey, you know what? You're probably not going to survive unless you're wearing a really good spacesuit. Here, I've got one for you.
Yeah, well, that... But,
time
I mean,
traveler this... gave it to me.
Yeah. A time traveler gave it to me for my first time travel voyage. There's a good story for you to have.
But that's the beauty of fiction. It's so malleable that you can always...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's push on. What do you actually think of Danny? Do you think Sam Anderson played the two characters? Do you think he played them differently enough?
It's tough because we really didn't get to see too much of Danny to see how Danny is. Admittedly, I like Danny so far. I wasn't really sure... how it was going to go, knowing how Moffat does do characters, but I actually like the way he's portraying the character. It kind of seemed like he was almost just playing Danny, who was a bit more scared and reserved, which I guess is okay. I guess it's very tough to kind of create two new characters at the same time. But I like Danny. I can't say that they were tremendously different for me, but they definitely were different.
I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, all they really did was give him an afro.
Yeah.
But then I thought about it more, and I thought, well, we see a bit more humour from him that we don't really get from Danny, so maybe he has actually managed to do something with Orson, who doesn't seem to be quite as down on himself as Danny. What about the little boy, though, young Rupert? He was excellent, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was very good.
Very good. He's got big things ahead of him, that young man. He's going to be on stage in a Roald Dahl production of a Roald Dahl musical in the near future. And he's been in something else recently as well.
Good for him.
Absolutely.
No, I must admit, I never thought about it with the Pinks, but I didn't. I think in my head I don't think Orson Pink was very well developed. And I don't want to put that down to script or actor or direction. It just the end result was is that I didn't really, I kind of think in my head was that this was Danny Pink with an afro.
Right.
He didn't. He wasn't that distinct, but at the same time, it didn't damage. And maybe he was directed to pull it back and to keep it mysterious and vague and not to overshadow the fact that Danny Pink is meant to be the central focus and not Orson. So in fairness to both actor, script and direction, it could have been an intentional choice to keep mm-hmm. Orson being fairly similar to Danny, like a sort of background version. So you're constantly connecting him to Danny, but he's not overtaking from the fact that your focus should be on the father. So maybe that's the reason. But yeah, didn't feel as much
distinction in the restaurant
there.
Who's just been called a murderer.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I Clara gives these reasons for why she behaved in that way, but that wasn't like the Clara that we've seen over the last, you know, 5 or 6 episodes of Doctor Who, where she stopped being Impossible Girl and become Clara. I didn't really get the feeling that Clara would say something like that to someone, whether or not you're in the high pressure world of dating in London or not.
Well, so I was just going to say, we hadn't really seen her in any dating situations. I mean, people can say what they want about her relationship with Matt Smith, but I never really had that they were in a relationship thing. I actually thought, like in Time of the Doctor, when she had him pretend to be her boyfriend, she was more so, you know, covering the fact that she didn't have a boyfriend rather than trying to I also want you to be this to me, you know, like,
but then there is that truth field. The truth field makes it pretty clear that she is attracted to him. I don't think she's trying to be his boyfriend any more than Smith's trying to be her girlfriend. But I think there's meant to be a sort of connection between the two, which is, which at that time for her is possibly a little bit physical as well. Until
But at the same time too, if you put any of us in a truth field around any of our female friends, we're going to be able to say that we have an attraction to them, because a lot of them are attractive in more ways than one, you know. And it's just, that doesn't equate to I want to be dating this person or trying to date this person.
Can I just be very, very old fashioned, so I don't have any female friends?
That's fine.
That aren't family.
I was going to. Wasn't going to go there. I was tempted, but I don't know. I just kind of felt that the whole point, especially, I kind of felt the deep breath sort of really hammered this down, that there was an attraction there. There was a sort of love on her part, even if she wasn't quite sure really what it was or didn't really want to sort of try and acknowledge. I agree with Brian. I don't think she was actively looking like Rose was looking for the Doctor as a boyfriend. But I think there was meant to be a sort of like a subconscious attraction or need for him that was growing.
And the other argument too is we didn't get to see the Doctor and Clara actually on a date. You know, two people on a date are definitely minding their P's and Q's on the first one and trying not to make any mistakes and so on. And then as they have more dates with that person, they tend to get more relaxed with each other. So, you know, that argument could be there as well. With the Doctor, they're just two buds hanging out, and maybe she is attracted to him in some way, but they're not actually, you know, doing that dating scene situation.
In a funny way, I mean, even though I would never suggest it should ever go down that route, the way they did it with Clara and the Doctor was a lot better than Rose and the Doctor, because the only suggestion that she was getting slightly interested in the Doctor was roundabout sort of Day of the Doctor, even Time of the Doctor. And that again is a slow, gradual build-up. So again, you can sort of You can enjoy that. I mean, I actually quite like it by Time of the Doctor, where there is this sort of devotion to the Doctor, which feels like a sort of love without the kissy kissy. There's sort of an almost, you know, she's really there for him, and I kind of like that because it's built up slowly. It's not just sort of being pushed in you, and that works for me. I think maybe that's, again, as I say with Danny, I have no issue with Danny at all, and I think he's probably quite a gentle character that I would like. I like Rory. And there's not that much difference between the two in a lot of ways.
No.
But, you know, Rory was allowed to gradually feed into the show. I think when you make a character a plot device and a character foil, it sometimes can feel a bit, feel a little pressured. And I think also, as I said before with Deep Breath, I was enjoying this weird relationship that the two of them had, the Doctor and Clara, where there was a sort of like a symbiotic need to sort of help each other through their own vulnerabilities, which was sort of building in Deep Breath. That, you know, it wasn't about romance. It was the fact that they both needed each other in a sort of unusual way to be strong. And then that sort of was knocked aside for Danny and the Doctor doing his usual distance thing. And I thought that was kind of a shame because there was something interesting going there, which wasn't love. Like it was almost a bit more like Donna and the Doctor. And I was enjoying that. So maybe I'm a little against Danny because I felt that sort of shattered that, because it's got this new guy who's being forced in a bit like River Song was forced in. And maybe I'm just revolting against that a bit. I don't know.
Perhaps.
Perhaps.
Perhaps. I wonder if maybe now is the time for us to have a quick assessment of the last month of Doctor Who and where we would place the episodes in a kind of personal ranking system of four.
Okay.
Brian, would you like to go first?
I would probably right now put Into the Dalek at first in the most liked. Then I would probably put Listen, then Deep Breath, then Robot of Sherwood.
Right. James?
It's a difficult one. I think I would probably put Listen or Deep Breath first, actually.
Okay.
I'm not sure which. Let's go with Listen, because I think it was a better balance than the Deep Breath, although Deep Breath had some really fun Doctor Who and Clara scene, Doctor and Clara scenes, separate and together. But I think I'll put the top one, yeah. I'll put Listen. I will then put... I think actually I might put Robots of Sherwood, then Deep Breath, pretty much on the same, and then Into the Dalek last.
Okay. I think I would...
It's difficult, isn't it?
No, I would definitely put Into the Dalek first and then Listen. But Listen would be very close to Into the Dalek. I'm kind of undecided on Deep Breath and Robot of Sherwood. Robot of Sherwood is relentlessly postmodern and it pisses me off a little bit because I think it could have been better than that. As I mentioned to someone, as I mentioned via email to one of our Castobus colleagues, someone should smack Matt Gatiss's face with some Stephen R. Lawhead. That's the way you recreate Robin Hood. I think one of you guys mentioned it last week about how he's basically Robin Hood. There's only one way of doing Robin Hood. You know, like the Gatiss said, that's bollocks, effing bollocks.
I don't mind that. I did find though rewatching it, there was small things in the episode which were just too trite, like the arrow at the end being used between the three of them. It was too happy. It was too silly, and you know it just. So there were things which I think knock it down.
I think now the problem with Listen is I'm not going to be letting Brucey watch it, whereas he's watched the last three. But I'm not going to let him watch Listen because I think it's too scary for him. Whereas the last three, I don't think were too scary for him.
Would you let him watch Blink?
No, I don't think I'd watch. No, I definitely wouldn't.
Just
let him
interested watch which ones you think were perhaps in it.
He likes robots, which is why he's watched the ones with the robots in, basically. He's not going to be watching. He's definitely not going to watch Listen
worth
until his age is probably doubled.
Worth mentioning there was no robots in this one.
No, there wasn't.
No. I don't recall any subtext to Promised Land particularly.
No, I don't think I spotted
it. Yeah, it did seem like the first one without anything.
Yeah. I go Into the Dalek, Listen, Deep Breath, Robot Sherwood.
So little like me, it's just we've got a reversal on our top. No, we haven't quite got it now. No matter.
No, they're all different.
Different. That's good.
Okay. Well, as we've seen, I'm going to move on now. Before I do,
because we brought up the Promised Land, and I wanted to bring this up because
have you found it?
We talked. Yeah, I have. Do you guys want to go?
Wow, yeah,
it's really cool. There's nice tea and a crazy lady. we brought up the whole is it possibly the Master versus Doctor thing. So I wanted to bring this up too. I had a couple friends over the other day. We watched the episode together, and one of them had said this, and I found it very interesting. In Deep Breath, there's the debate of did he push the Clockwork Man or did the Clockwork Man kill himself?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have in Into the Dalek, you have Missy saving the woman who sacrificed herself so that everybody else could live. Say, for example, that the Clockwork Man actually jumped in order to end everything and save everybody. If that's the case, then it looks like Missy is taking people into the Promised Land who have sacrificed themselves to either save the Doctor or people around him.
Right.
And I wonder if that's where they're going. I wonder if this Missy character, as deluded as she is in some way thinking she's helping and you know, I know that we have her saying that it's his, or she's his boyfriend or whatever, but we didn't really know if she was up to any good or evil things. I wonder if in some kind of deluded way she thinks she's connected to him and all these people that save him, she thinks she's doing him a favor by saving them. But I thought it was an interesting theory, because while I kind of thought we were going to leave that question open-ended, it seems like there's a possibility at least that it might get resolved, whether or not he pushed or he jumped. But I thought it was an interesting theory nonetheless, because like, if you look at it that way, the two characters that were saved did sacrifice themselves.
They did, yeah.
So I thought it was interesting enough to mention.
Could give an answer to that ambiguous question. And what's with Capaldi constantly breaking the fourth wall? And again, they did it this week. And
I missed that.
What do you mean?
Near the beginning, he looks directly at camera again and speaks. I think it might be when he says, listen. But it's
yes.
I mean, it's not really, really bad stuff, but it's like, I think it's the third.
Well, at least he's not bemoaning the uselessness of his sonic screwdriver.
Right.
Well, we need John Guiler to do this one effectively, but he's, you know, he's not saying even the sonic screwdriver won't get me out of this one.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, the Tom Baker.
Yeah. And where was the sonic screwdriver, by the way?
He had it.
Not much.
Yeah, maybe they're dulling it down.
Yeah, I think they
You know what I heard, by the way? I don't know if I told you guys this. Nick Roboto, the guy who made the Sonic for the show, he has opened his own business, so he still makes the Sonics for the show, and he makes the occasional prop, but he doesn't work officially on the show as the prop guy anymore. So he went to the filming of the Christmas episode now.
Okay.
And he was asking them just like all sorts of general stuff as you do, and they got to talking about the Sonic, and they showed him the props. Apparently, they have crazy glued the flick to open feature on the Sonic completely closed because Peter Capaldi refuses to flick it open because he feels that's a Matt Smith thing. And now if you look it into Dalek, he's actually, he has it open in Into Dalek, and he's got it open the way that the Sonic was originally intended to be used, which was thumb sliding up that cage section rather than flicking it, because that was created by Matt. I'm a little disappointed in this because to me, it's just a feature of the Sonic, and Matt's thing was very much Sonic with it closed, flick it open to read it, where I felt that Peter could easily get away with flicking it open for like long range or heavy duty jobs and keeping it closed for like closer range or small jobs. And that would have been an interesting use. But he's apparently outright, and I'm trying to pay attention to how he uses it now in the rest of the episodes, which so far only one of them did he actually have it open. But apparently he just flat out refuses it, and poor Nick was said he was pretty upset to see his Sonics caked in crazy glue. So I'm also kind of curious now to see if we can see any close-ups of it where we can see the crazy glue ourselves, because it is high def TV now. But I found that interesting. Like he just that's something he outright refuses to do.
I can see why he has, and I think Peter Capaldi's right. I think it is a very Matt Smith gesture, and if he had done it, you'd be thinking, oh, it's a bit like Matt Smith there. And well, I think he consciously doesn't want to be like any specific doctor, does he?
Sure, I get that. But at the same time, it's a function of the device. Like, for instance, as an actor, you don't pick up a telephone and go, somebody else has pressed buttons on this before, so I'm going to use my nose to do it, because that's not what he did.
Tom Baker would.
Tom Baker would. You're so right. No, but seriously, like the way I described it, if you change the functionality of it rather than flick to read it, if you flicked it another way, or if you use the original intended way, which was thumb slide it up, you're changing the function, but you're keeping it. It seems like you're limiting that device to yourself now. And it's fine. It's his doctor. He can do what he wants. I'm not trying to say he's doing anything wrong. I'm just saying I find it sad, because it's a little bit like, I don't know, you have one of the coolest tools in the universe and you're not even using its full functionality. And I just find that
okay.
A shame.
What's crazy glue, by the way?
Do you call it super glue there? We have both.
Yeah.
Crazy oh right, okay, that's right. Okay, I don't.
Yeah, they're the same thing.
I thought maybe it made you a bit bonkers, or it didn't. You weren't sure whether it was going to work or not. You just had to wait and see.
Well, it's probably called that because people seem to be crazy enough to glue their fingers together.
So if it's glued down, so it's permanently. It can't slide at all now.
Yeah. Well, as at least within the Christmas episode, that's why I'm. Because he has only seen it again since filming of the Christmas episode has started. So I don't know when throughout this season it gets, if it even gets glued down, or if it did get glued down in this season. Because, like I said, Into Dalek, it's open at least twice. So far, the other episodes, he hasn't opened it. So, but you know, the other thing is too, with Matt Smith, he had two versions of the prop. He had one that was able to be open, and he had one that was permanently closed. He had a couple other versions of it as well, but I mean, those were two. So rather than crazy glue it down, they could have just had a couple made that were permanently closed if he really wasn't going to open it. And in a sense, it is fine because the thing does look good just being used normally with a flashing light rather than having the claw section open. But the claw section is a pretty neat feature, I thought. It's just something. It's actually the one and only thing I really like about the Sonic. But you know, at least in the Christmas episode, yes, it's super glued so that it cannot extend and open any longer.
Okay. On a Christmas theme as well, and this isn't really a spoiler, but there's rumors that Nick Frost is been cast in it, of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and that other unforgettable movie that he made with Simon Pegg.
You're talking Paul, of course.
That's the one, I think. Yeah, yeah. And of course, he was in Spaced as well with Jessica Stevenson.
That's a good show.
Yeah. Okay. Philip Morris has been speaking on Facebook, and we need to have a few words about this, and because as much as we like Philip Morris, and he's doing a lot of work for Doctor Who, and he's done a lot of work for Doctor Who, he's been saying some things that are hugely critical of Doctor Who at this current series, and in particular Stephen Moffat's sort of stewardship. For instance, he said, "I will always love Doctor Who, but not the small group of clique Uber fans that run it and surround it and are running it into the ground." On the ratings, he says, "The drop in viewing figures say it all, really. I guess the general public have an agenda too, viewing public walking away from Doctor Who. Strange lowest rating to date for this series so far," which is, he was speaking about, listen. "Lack of female writers. The point with women writers are Doctor Who, Cardiff, under Stephen Moffat, don't employ any screen credits since taking over showrunner, prove that." And I'm reading these as they are, so forgive me if they sound a bit barmy. He claims that they're cut and pastes of Sherlock, Moffat's episode, which stops. I've got to disagree there. I think, really, we've heard a few things about Stephen, about Philip Morris and what he's been, what he's doing and what his operation is and how complicated it is and what the timescales are, and that he has a certain amount of influence over BBC, or particularly over BBC Worldwide, because of these projects. And I think it is fair to say that he's not happy with the people that are running Doctor Who at the moment, but... and you guys can chime in with this if you like, but I'm going to say, Philip Morris, I think you've made your point now, and this tactic doesn't seem to be working. I think we should really let things just, you know, work themselves out without making these noises, which are becoming a little undignified.
Is he? This is devil's advocate. I'm one way or the other, but. Should he not be allowed to offer his opinion, though? If, as long as he does it outside of his remit in his own private company?
I think in most circumstances he would be able to, yeah. I just feel that with what we've heard, the three of us have heard, with relation to his organisation and what's going on with restorations of things, and what relationship he might have with the BBC and what beef he may have, he's made a few of these statements, and I think he's got to the point now where it's clearly not having any impact, or not the impact that he wants it to. So maybe time now is to try something different tactic wise if that's what he wants to spend his time doing.
Yeah, I suppose if it is a tactic like that, then yeah, I do agree. Otherwise, I mean, what's the difference between what we're doing, giving our opinions every week, and what he's doing? He's just more in the public eye right now because of those stories. But if he is doing it to try and get some influence with these stories as backing, then yeah, I do agree. It definitely would be time for a change.
Okay. Recommendations time, gentlemen. Does anyone have one? Or am I doing it? this week. Okay, my recommendation. Well, do you know what? I do have a recommendation. I've just watched City of Death.
Yeah.
Which I would have told you last week, but I wasn't here. So City of Death, which I've enjoyed immensely for the first time in a long while, actually. Thanks. I was really... usually when I watch City of Death, I am kind of taken by Romana, because Lala was rather wonderful in it. But I decided to spend more time watching or paying more attention to Julian Glover, and he's really, really excellent. I'm finding it quite sad that he hasn't been asked back since Doctor Who returned.
Mm.
Because he really is very good. That part two cliffhanger with Tancredi is absolutely superb. Watching that in 1979 must have been like, whoa. Even Tom Chadbourne's really good in it compared to him. I thought he was really poor in the Mysterious Planet. I think it was very much... I mean, it's not a great episode, is it? A great serial. And I think when we get to the end of Series 8, I think we really do need to perhaps follow up on Mr. Cavanagh's suggestion and have a look at the entire Trial of a Time Lord in some detail. City of Death obviously has a very good reputation, and it popped up as one of the most popular choices among our readers a few days ago when we were asking people in the wake of Robot of Sherwood what they felt was their most amusing Doctor Who story. And I it's also one that I've watched a lot, but I just felt watching it, I really appreciated it a lot more, mainly because I was watching Mr. Glover, who obviously his son was in Adventure of Space and Time as William Russell, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably now is a good time to mention. Have we heard about the recasting, Big Finish recasting?
Yes.
Oh yeah,
just the Barbara White. Morning.
How do you feel about that? I think it's quite good.
I don't. I mean, we talked about it a little bit with Ben Jackson, and now this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't know. I think one of the things that really sold me with Big Finish was you had the original actors reprising their roles, which made the stuff feel real and genuine to me, which is why I've always felt a lot of the stuff was canon in my mind. But once you start recasting voices, they got away with it in the show and the Five Doctors, of course, and I kind of was okay with that because it was an anniversary thing and there was no way around it kind of situation. And of course they did it again with John Guiler, but I do feel it's not something they should get in the habit of. It's okay for things like, you know, James Bond changes faces all the time, and so does the other characters in his series, and many other TV shows do it. But something like Doctor Who, it's constantly changing, it's constantly growing. The people are constantly becoming new all the time, and I think that just works for the show so well. And while Big Finish is nice to revisit the past and get extra stories, I think there are certain parts of the past which probably shouldn't be revisited, merely because those people are no longer here to lend their voices to. And it's just how it is for me, because especially whenever I hear somebody doing those particular characters, I'm always very well aware that it's not those characters. There's always, you know, an easy give in their voice. They're never going to be identical or 100%. So personally, I'm not that excited by it.
Okay. So that's Gemma Powell, who played Jacqueline Hill.
Yeah.
In Adventure in Space and Time. I do have, as well as City of Death, I do have another recommendation as well, actually. I stumbled across an episode of The New Avengers last week. And when... they repeated The New Avengers in the UK on... in the mid-90s, I think it was, on BBC Two. I think it was around the same time they were repeating Doctor Who and gave up. So then they started doing New Avengers. And I kind of largely dismissed them as not being very good. And they're perhaps not as good as the 60s ones. And... of course, you've got the famous link with the New Avengers and Doctor Who, because there's this story that the old Dennis Fisher Fourth Doctor doll had Gareth Hunt's head from the New Avengers, because someone broke the Tom Baker mold, or even if there ever was one. But I think that story's been largely debunked now. The episode I was watching, however, it had the chap who played Dr. Warlock in Pyramid of Mars in it. And it also had Kevin Stoney from The Invasion and where it was Tobias Vaughn, and it was Mavic Chen in the Daleks Master Plan, and it was about this mad guy who was able to control birds, and you probably need to watch the rest of it, really, which gets a bit silly to explain. But it was a good, fun episode, which I enjoyed. So I may be giving the new Avengers a proper rewatch at some point. So that's my recommendations for this time. I'm glad you were both quiet during my recommendations. I really hate it when you interrupt.
Good.
They're good recommendations, Christian. We're very proud of you.
I was kind of waiting for James to say something about the new Avengers, and he said absolutely nothing.
I've never really been into the Avengers, so right, I know very little about it to really make comment on, so I was very quiet.
We found Ryan, we found something he's not an expert on. Okay, James, recommendation.
Well, I'm going to recommend two Don Doc 2 ones. I said just a few minutes ago, I'm watching Space 1999 series season 2. And the reason I'm recommending it is because about 15 years ago yesterday, the moon was blasted out of orbit. So I kind of feel it's a good time for people to... Absolutely.
Never noticed?
I know. No one noticed. I mean, the show has them wondering whether there's anything left of the Earth, but really they should be just wondering if anyone noticed they're gone. But no, apparently not. And of course, there's a host of Doctor Who and Blake Seven Faces you'll see in Space 1999 in both series. And second season's quite interesting because they had a revision using, is it Fred Freeburger, who did the much-loved season 3 of Star Trek, which, of course, went down the pan, as did Space 1999 season 2's. They lost a lot of actors, changed the sets. It's not nearly as good. There's an interesting change in the film quality as well. It's a lot more crisper, interestingly. But yeah, but if you've got time and you've got some money in your pocket, go and get that.
Okay.
The only other thing I will mention is, because it's September the 14th, a close friend of Doctor Who, The Golden Girls, the American-US show, debuted on television in 1985. I couldn't think of a show further from, to be honest. I couldn't think of anything whatsoever to Doctor Who. But it was a good comedy show, which I have a very strong partial love
to. In fairness, they all had John Pertwee haircuts.
They did, yes, right. from different seasons.
all four of his haircuts.
Yes, yes.
Sophia's looked like the Stuart Fell stuntman version of not of Pertwee, the same Stuart Wing. Yeah, that's a brilliant comment. Yeah, I like that. Did you feel any Pertwee in Capaldi this week?
Well, I didn't touch him.
I didn't ask if you did. I asked if you felt that. Oh yes, I suppose I did actually. Yes, yeah, did. Carry on.
I don't know.
I can't say off. No. I can't say I did.
I think I think I felt a lot of, apart from the listen bit.
Yeah.
I think that was possibly the main. I think that was the first time we saw the Capaldi Doctor for the full episode, I think. I don't think he was echoing anyone else. I think he was Peter Capaldi's Doctor.
Mm. Yes, I'd agree with that.
I will say that when he smiled, since we brought up his smile before, I got a very quick flash of Paul McGann when he smiled and said hearts plural in the TV movie. For some reason, I don't know if, like, I've seen Paul McGann smile a lot, and he doesn't really ever do that smile that he did in that scene. Like, something made me think that was done very early in the morning and he was still waking up or something. And I got that same kind of flash in Capaldi's smile there, that it was just a little awkward, a little weird, but still good, you know? So I got a hint like that. I don't think that was intentional by any means, but I didn't get a Pertwee one this time.
Okay.
It's your recommendation time, isn't it, Brian?
Oh, mine. Well, it's interesting that you brought up pretty quickly in there Star Trek Season 3.
Yeah.
Because mine is actually... It's a recommendation for a fan film series rather than an actual production on TV or in the theaters, because I really haven't been watching much else outside of Return of the Saint, and I've started catching up on the latest series of Midsummer Murders as well. When the new guy comes in, John Barnaby, I forget the actor's name, unfortunately. Which are quite good, actually. I've watched the first three, and they're really good stories. I love that show. So yeah, whatever. I'll recommend that too, since I really love that one. So there you go. But
what, you recommended Midsommar?
Yeah, I recommend.
I think that's Midsommar. The only. I think that is possibly the show that gets recommended the most, other than Doctor Who, on this podcast.
I think so. It's good. It's good. I like
it's
it.
Good.
You know,
I like the way that they managed to bring him in and bring him the character's own qualities.
Yeah.
To the show without kind of making him a clone of John Nettles.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And considering one of the episodes that I just watched, it had a woman who was supposed to be dead gave birth to her brother's son, and that son was having an affair with the woman, his mother's sister, but he didn't know that. And I just thought, like, my God, where else do you get a story like that aside from Jerry Springer? You know? Except Jerry Springer just doesn't do it with the kind of taste or tact that this show has. But anyway, but my other recommendation, it's a couple of guys I actually met this weekend at the convention I was at, and they're cool. I may potentially be doing something with them. I don't know, but I want to recommend their work just because it speaks for itself, which is Starship Farragut. So you can go to starshipfarragut.com for their stuff, and it's continuing the Star Trek adventures with a whole new crew, whole new team, but set basically in the world of like the season 3 style Star Trek. And I say that because one of the creators, producers, John Broughton, he makes all the uniforms, well, most of the uniforms that are used in the piece, and he went for the season 3 style, and they're immaculate. It's not like what you see usually in fan productions or even costumes. It actually looks like the costumes from the show. But one of the other producers and actors, both of them are actors in the piece as well, is Michael Bednar, and he recreated the sets pretty much 100% accurate. I mean, I'm looking at them and they're just gorgeous. They look identical. And what he even did was he created the Star Trek sets exactly how they were made when they were filming the show in the 60s. So you can actually walk his sets exactly as they would have walked their sets. It's in the same set configuration. So everything's connected with hallways and different rooms, but he actually used their floor plans. But their cinematography is really brilliant. The costumes and the sets, like I said, everything together, it's not really, to me, it's not really like a fan production. It's amazing. Like to say that, doing fan productions myself, but I know how hard it is to actually make things look professional. These guys look professional.
I've seen trailers of this when they first started doing it. I really fancied watching it, but I just never got round to doing it yet.
Yeah, you know, they were very kind. Like I said, we were talking the whole time. We were stationed next to each other. One of my friends is working on a project with them. That's how I got to know them. And, you know, they just handed me DVDs of all their episodes. And, that was really nice. So I'm going to check them all out. Like, but the footage that they were just showing me on their phone alone, you know, it's really well done. It's really top-notch stuff. And, you know, they said they've been talking about potentially doing an original series, but they are enjoying doing the Star Trek thing and, you know, getting everybody together to do an original thing, an original idea, as is always the case with us filmmakers, is tough to get your group together to do something like that. But I really hope they do, because, like I said, their cinematography and their quality of work is really, really high. So I'd like to see them do something original, just because out of curiosity, I would just like to see that. But if you're a Star Trek fan, and you're certainly of the classic series in that, the original with Kirk and crew, I would definitely recommend this series, because
this is phase two, isn't it? We're talking about.
No, this is not phase two.
Oh,
right. This is Starship Farragut. Phase two is a different project.
Beg your pardon. Right,
yeah. Yeah, Starship Farragut is phase two was continuing Kirk, so they had their own James T. Kirk and other people.
That's right.
This is a completely different ship,
yeah.
Completely different right crew. On. So they're a little bit more free in that respect as far as a fan series. You're not limiting yourself. Like what I'm doing with the 10th Doctor in my series, I'm limiting myself because I have to try and act like him as best I can. These guys get to play their own characters. All they have is the prime directives and so on of that particular era of Star Trek that they have to adhere to, and they can't do certain types of storylines, of course. But it's just, you know, like I said, it's very well done. I was very impressed looking at the footage, the CGI work that they do in it, the set building, everything just looked like a professional. They have a proper studio that they have this stuff put in, you know, they do Kickstarter programs for it, but how they spend their money, they just make it look like it's a proper professional production. These guys, they do it like it's their job, and they still work full-time day jobs while they still do this. I don't know how they pull it off, but they pull it off so well. So yeah, I'm going to recommend those guys.
Okay. I've just looked it up, and apparently there's a crossover between the two as well.
No, there may be. They do work together with other with other
how complicated
productions.
Because I always remember one of the people involved with Phase 2 has the same surname as me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Now, James, have you done your recommendation?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought you had. We've just got some sad news just popped up. Angus Lennie's died yesterday. He was in The Ice Warriors and Terror of the Zygons.
Right.
And he was in The Great Escape. In Terror of the Zygons, he was the bagpipe playing Angus in Terror of the Zygons.
Oh, him? Oh, I do know.
Yeah, he's passed away. To be honest with you, I thought he would died a few years ago. So,
suppose you better quickly just, you know, a couple of minutes, just mention, obviously, Jane Baker. We never spoke about that from Pip and Jane.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I do apologize. I thought you'd done that last week.
No, we didn't.
Right. Okay. And last week, of course, we found out that Jane Baker of Pip and Jane Baker had sadly passed away, which again brings us back to what we were talking about earlier, I think, about having a good look at the Trial of the Time Lord, because they were quite, the pair of them, quite instrumental in keeping that serial. Basically making sure it was finished, I suppose, weren't they? Yeah. I mean, we can quite easily criticise Time and the Rani, and we have done on many occasions, and it, you know, it isn't a great production, but at the same time, as I've postulated on many occasions, a writer cannot purely be blamed for a bad TV script for the end product. And Mark of the Rani was quite good, I always remember, and it's one... I remember that one from childhood. And they created the Rani as well. And Jane Baker was one of the very few women to have written for Doctor Who.
Mm.
And, of course, they wrote lots of children's TV for the BBC as well in the 80s.
They did. Anything indeed. No, not really. I think obviously, the Rani is funny how Pip and Jane are often derided, possibly by... me and you, but
and by a lot of fans, and yet and by their a lot creation of fans. Is one of yes. the ones that is wanted back more than any other.
Absolutely, it's one that people it's very few people, especially from a Mark of the Rani, have a bad thing to say about. So it's always worth remembering that there's two sides to every coin, or three sides when you've got two writers, four sides maybe, I don't know.
Yes, indeed. So that brings us to the close of our podcast with a K for this week. At the beginning of the show, you will have heard the voice of John Guiler portraying either the First Doctor or the Fourth Doctor. We're interested to find out which one you like best. It's not going to change anything, but we'd like to know which one you like best. So feel free to tell us or message us about any other topic that we've discussed today, or you can leave your comments on Castorbris. You can even record a response to anything we might have said on audio as well. That's a useful feature. That's like commenting with your voice.
Mm.
Almost a conversation. Until next time, enjoy Time Heist, and we'll be discussing it next week. Bye-bye.